You are listening to 97.3 LPFM, and this is Open Source RVA. Open Source RVA is WRIR's weekly audio news digest. Today on Open Source RVA, we talk with Brian Moran, chairman of the Democratic Party of Virginia, about voting trends in Central Virginia, and speak with author G.G. Amato about her new book of historical fiction about the slave Gabriel. We also speak with musician Samson Trent and Richard Cook of the Cultural Arts Center at Glen Allen about this weekend's Ukefest. But first, here are some of the top stories making headlines right now.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. Virginians saw less of Hurricane Sandy than widely anticipated, but life as usual was still disrupted for many residents. The Commonwealth began to experience the most direct of Sandy's effects on late Saturday, and by Tuesday the storm began to let up, at least in state. During the course of the storm, folks in different parts of Virginia saw winds up to 68 miles per hour, close to 10 inches of rain and snow over 8 inches, though Richmond's experience was far milder. The mountainous regions of western Virginia continued to deal with the lingering snow and icy roads that come with it throughout the week. Flooding and downed trees in northern Virginia and elsewhere shut down more than 280, mostly back roads, and the metro system in Nova is still running on a limited schedule. Virginia State Police Public Relations Director Corinne Geller informs that statewide from Sunday through early Tuesday, troopers responded to over 2,500 crashes and disabled vehicles. The storm was deemed responsible for two metro area traffic deaths, those of Richmond residents Keith D. Fordham, 52, and Michael T. Overton, 51, when the vehicle Fordham was driving crashed into a light pole. Over 600 Virginia National Guard personnel were called in for Sandy, poised and ready to assist with high water transport, reconnaissance patrols, and cleanup. As of Thursday, they have all been released from active duty and returned to home stations. The Guard reports that they moved 42 civilians to safety and went on almost 60 damage assessment patrols. Richmond City Council met at 12:30 today to vote to officially confirm Mayor Dwight Jones's Saturday declaration of a state of emergency for the city, though his declaration was lifted just before 8 a.m. on Tuesday. Governor Bob McDonald's declaration of a statewide state of emergency, however, extends to June of next year. FEMA is authorized to deploy federal resources if needed, though McDonald himself announced on Tuesday that Virginia is in a position to offer assistance to states that suffered far more damage, and that he spoke with President Obama to offer that help to New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, and Delaware. Included in the governor's declaration of a state of emergency was a request that Virginia residents in areas impacted by the storm should have late fees waived for such things as Department of Motor Vehicle registrations, licenses, permits, or renewals for the month of October, as long as they are submitted on or before November 9th. Absentee voting hours will also be extended through the remaining absentee period, which ends tomorrow, November 3rd, and further information is available on local general registrar offices' websites, over the phone, or the State Board of Elections Facebook page. An acceptable form of ID is still necessary, and absentee eligibility requirements still apply. Considerably less Virginians lost power to Hurricane Sandy as compared to this year's June derecho. At the height of Virginia outages on late Monday, including numbers from Dominion Virginia Power, Appalachian Power, and Virginia Electric Cooperatives, 23,000 customers were without power across the state. According to Dominion's website, power is expected to have been restored to the majority of remaining locations on Thursday night. The 1708 Gallery's 5th annual Inlight Richmond is slated to illuminate the downtown area tonight. The one-night outdoor art exhibition will take over first Friday, starting at 6 p.m. with a lighted lantern parade. This year's Inlight has been curated by Melissa Ho of the Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden and will once again showcase local, national, and international artists as they alter sidewalks, alleyways, and parking decks with light-based art and projections. Log on to Open Source RVA Facebook page for more information or go to 1708gallery.org.
Does anyone know the name Gabriel Prosser?
Gabriel Prosser, or Prosser's Gabriel as he referred to himself, or perhaps even Gabriel Bingham if you meet one of his ancestors living in the Richmond area, may well be the most important founding father you know nothing about. This is because Gabriel's ascension to the pantheon of America's founding fathers ended abruptly. A slave born in 1776 on the Henrico County plantation of Thomas Prosser, Gabriel led what may well have been the largest, most ambitious, and certainly the most well-planned slave revolt in U.S. history. The plan was cut short by a massive storm, possibly a hurricane, and in the days after August 30, 1800, he and his co-conspirators were rounded up. Dozens were hanged, ironically by some of the very men who had led the American Revolution that at its heart was the fight for the same concepts of liberty that Gabriel fought for. Richmond author Gigi Amato takes a step toward filling the gaps in Gabriel's life in her new young adult historical novel, Come August, Come Freedom, The Bellows, The Gallow, and The Black General Gabriel. I'm here with Gigi Amato, and she is the author of the recently released book, Come August, Come Freedom, which is subtitled The Bellows, The Gallows, and The Black General Gabriel. Really excited to have you on the show, which is why I'm falling over my words. Gabriel is he's just a fascinating character,
yeah.
And I think it's really neat that somebody has put his life and story into a book. And it is a fiction book, but it's
right.
Also historical fiction based on a lot of research, right?
Right, and thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk with you about it. Yeah, this is my first work of historical fiction, so it's my fourth book for young adults. And the first one, I think every work of fiction requires some research just to make sure that the world that you're building really is a believable world and reliable for your reader. But this was the first work of historical fiction where I really had to go into the archives and start to try to more deeply understand the secondary sources and what people have been saying, what historians have been saying about this story for the last 212 years.
Now, when did you, well, I guess two questions. What about Gabriel sucked you in and made you pick this as your first topic for a historical fiction novel? And then secondly, how long did it take you to do this research?
So what about it isn't just totally captivating?
Besides
the fact that that it's a piece of history that's so tied to our city and to the surrounding counties and to the whole state and just building up and to the early Republic era of our nation and to that period just around the globe where, we were afire as a globe with the ideas of liberty and freedom and the Haitian Revolution, the French Revolution. So to me, it's one of those stories.
And our revolution.
I was going to say that. And the American Revolution. Yeah, right. That one. So if I just look at that piece of history where you have a young man, a 24-year-old enslaved man who is highly skilled as a blacksmith. So he's an artisan. He can read. He can write. And in looking at the sources that are there, you see that he understood that he had been left out of the revolution, of the promise of the American Revolution. And he realized that he felt like he had the means to do something about it and that he was kind of acting in a tradition, a revolutionary tradition.
So he saw himself, as we were discussing at a point earlier, he really saw himself as an extension of our own revolution?
Well, that's how I interpret it. When I read the documents about that kind of talk about the unfolding of the conspiracy or the rebellion that he had planned, and it seems like everybody agrees it's a rebellion that hundreds of men from around the state were involved in, maybe thousands of men, and maybe even people beyond Virginia knew about it. What comes through from the...
There were hangings in North Carolina, right?
There were hangings in North Carolina. I didn't read any of the primary resources that could specifically tie those back to...
this rebellion?
To Gabriel.
Okay.
Although when James Monroe was writing about it to other people, he indicated even far beyond the borders. And there are some things I read in secondary resources that state that even up into Philadelphia, people may have been involved and known about it.
Now, real quick, just for to set the stage for
orient people,
mm-hmm. folks. I mean, what's so very interesting about Gabriel is that he, his contemporaries at this time, really are people like Monroe,
sure.
who's later a president, but who was General George Washington's aide de camp.
Right.
Jefferson writes about him.
right?
Or about the rebellion,
right?
He's topic of conversation among the people that we know as the founders of our country.
Sure, and they were after the same thing, right? So it was an 18-year-old or so, James Monroe, who was in the Continental Army, who liberated an arsenal of weapons from Lord Dunmore in Williamsburg. Right. The exact same, what Gabriel wanted to do. He wanted to liberate the arsenal on the Capitol grounds in Virginia when James Monroe was the governor.
And you call him a general on the book title.
Yeah.
And he really is. I mean, when you look at what his plan was, it was detailed.
It was definitely a detailed military plan. In the trial documents, the men around him elected him their leader and called him general, elected him general. There was a vote one night in August between two men, Jack Ditcher and Gabriel. And the trial records say that Gabriel won by a large margin and was elected their general.
Gabriel's a big guy, but Ditcher is described as just a giant, right?
Right. And now I had Ditcher. I don't have Jack Ditcher in the book because...
he's a troubled character.
He is. I had him in the first few drafts, but there was something different about the energy of the book when Jack Ditcher was in it. I kind of had to pit Jack Ditcher and Gabriel against one another, which is sort of how it felt to me as I was reading the trial documents. And, mm-hmm. Ditcher had some different ideas, and the vote was between Jack Ditcher and Gabriel. But what I was trying to create with this story was really to bring it more kind of beyond this military plan, like extending it out to what was the motivation of all the men who were gathering. Certainly they were all enslaved men, and their motivation was to secure their freedom.
Right.
But what I was trying to draw a picture of is that these were also family men, men who had wives and children and brothers and sisters. And so...
And Ditcher did not, right? He was a sort of a free-roaming...
I think that if you're interested in reading about that, right? So James Sidbury and Douglas Edgerton both spend a little bit of time, spend more time thinking about Jack Ditcher than I do in the book. For me, the energy he was bringing to the fiction was like, this is too masculine. I'm trying to draw this picture of, I was spending time in the book with his mother, who's a fictional character,
so
his wife, Nan.
You build this story that really is very much a family story for the first, more than half of the first part of the book. You get to know Gabriel. You get to know Nan, his wife.
Right.
You get to know his mother, Ma. Right. Very well, and you get to know a number of the slaves that are on the Prosser farm really well. I mean, you do a wonderful job of sort of painting this community.
Thank you so much.
That's an extended family.
Thank you. That's kind of what else I was going for, so I'm really, yay.
It worked.
I'm happy. Thank you for saying that. Because as I was doing research about the institution of slavery during this period in the early Republic in the 1800s, everything I was reading was new to me, and I kind of making me realize that the things that I had learned or taken away or kind of been carrying around as an adult, how I was thinking of slavery was very different from some of the patterns and interactions and acts that were occurring among enslaved communities. I mean, I definitely was getting this picture of during this period of the early Republic, mobility. People were moving around in the neighborhood, in the region, a little bit more than they were later.
Yeah. I've read a little bit about that, and I've talked to some historians, and it seems like Ed Ayers had related mm-hmm. this. Ed Ayers, University of Richmond, who's mm-hmm. written, of course, a lot about slavery. And I was going to ask you, the other two people you had mentioned are people who've also written about Gabriel, I'm assuming?
That's right. So when I referenced the secondary resources, probably the three historians that I relied on the most in reading the secondary resources were Douglas Edgerton, James Sidbury, and then the historian Philip J. Schwartz, who has just come out with a new book that is from the University of Virginia Press. I think it's released this month already or later this month. That's the full documentation of all the primary sources related to Gabriel.
Okay.
Kind of all in one place.
Neat.
So
I'm going to go find
that. Yeah, go get that. And then there's also a new book out about Gabriel's rebellion called, I think the title is Whispers of Rebellion. And I believe the author's Michael Nichols.
I
haven't read that
one.
Yet.
I've
started
it. I haven't read it either, but I've
that one
heard
came
about
out a little late for me to And I think he's had, I think he has some different ideas, sort of changing his the interpretation of the story a little bit from earlier.
Well, Ayers, what was interesting about talking to him and sort of talking about what the institution of slavery right. was like in that period versus the later period. And I don't know if you came across this in your research. I probably would have occurred significantly later mm-hmm. and probably well beyond the bounds of where you were looking. But I think it was like in the 1820s or 30s, there was actually a vote in the General Assembly in Virginia to consider freeing the slaves. That they would, you know, we're done with the institution of slavery. It failed. And right. then after that, what he had said was that that was really kind of where the institution itself really hardened and became much more or much less. It was never friendly, but it right. became much more an institution than just sort of a societal norm. Which I thought was fascinating. I mean, there was this early period, and that, I guess, mm-hmm. sort of plays into some of what you see in that history.
Right. And so what I was looking at in the primary resources regarding the rebellion, you know, kind of the people who were testifying against Gabriel and against one another were men, and mm-hmm. they were primarily enslaved men. And I believe that's because there was a law at the time that said a slave— an enslaved person could not testify against a free person. Mm-hmm. And so I've read, for example, there were no real trials relating to the rebellion in Petersburg. And that what I've read is largely that's because a lot of the men involved in Petersburg were free.
Were free, wow, okay.
And so to have people involved in Richmond testifying against the men in Petersburg really wouldn't hold up because of the difference in their legal status.
So did those folks get off scot-free or...
Right. I think there was no charges really brought, although the evidence in the primary documents says that, you know, like Sam Bird, well, he was an enslaved man from Petersburg, and he was tried in Richmond and hung, and he was recruiting into Petersburg. But the thing that really kind of led me to go down this different road in the novel was listening to it sort of sounded like that as you're reading it, you know, reading the primary sources of men testifying against one another, and around the edges of those documents you see these guys moving back and forth from Henrico to Richmond, visiting their wives, visiting right. their families, gathering for family gatherings like funerals and weddings, worship at Young Spring, which we now think of as Bryan Park. Yep. And so even though the men in the documents, the men in the trials who had been recruited by Gabriel weren't really testifying about their family life, this is the picture that was being drawn for me, that, you know, they were taking these actions on behalf of not only their own freedom, but the freedom just to be a man, the freedom to be a man and love your wife and live with her and care for your children and have that intact family.
So again, this theme of family, of this being bigger than just an individual desire to walk away from whatever binds you have.
Sure, that's my interpretation. Now, I haven't seen historians write it that way, no, but you here know, they're I'm... testifying of what they were doing was yeah. you know, going to visit their wives.
Well, it could be, again, I mean, this story, it kind of makes you imagine that you can imagine,
like meditate on it, right? Meditate on right. history.
Yeah, and you almost kind of feel yourself going into this history. Mm-hmm. And so, like, Ditcher mm-hmm. and Gabriel, it almost seems like that was somewhat the difference between the two of them is Gabriel's... what his rebellion was about was something different than what Ditcher's rebellion was about. And that vote almost felt to me like it was the people aligning behind these higher principles rather than behind just this idea of let's go and kill a bunch of people and get free.
Right. Well, they definitely seem to be two different types of men. So Gabriel could read and he could write. And I believe that Jack Ditcher could not. Gabriel was a trade. He was skilled and trained in this essential trade. If we just look around the room that we're in, like how much of what's in here we would have had to go and get from a blacksmith rather than Lowe's or whatever fancy place you get.
He
you know,
these
equipment
guys cornered
from
the market back.
Right,
they
right.
were the Walmart of their
all
day.
Of it. Yeah, window hinges, doorknobs, chains, latches, everything that would make a city or a
nails.
Home or absolutely like nails by the tons. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that some of the qualities that we can see just in what we know, like factually about Gabriel, versus the very little bit of information that we know about Jack Ditcher. Gabriel had those leadership qualities that, you know, that we look for. He was tall, you know, 6'3", so he had the stature and the presence of a leader. And he was, you know, like I said, highly skilled, and he could read and write. He was more educated than a lot of the men around him. So naturally you would gravitate, right? I think.
Gabriel,
well, plus,
yeah,
his, plus his wife. Plus his wife was involved. His wife, Nan, mm-hmm. or Nanny. So some.
Who ends up eventually sold, right?
Well,
my understanding is like the Tennessee or someplace.
Or Kentucky, maybe. Right. So that's where making the distinction, I think, between the public, available public written record of public history versus the, you know, the written private family history, you have to sort of extrapolate and make some choices in fiction writing about, you know, where to go with the plot and with the story. And so
now
the primary sources
don't
really speak to the outcome of what happened to Gabriel's wife. The primary sources recognize her as his wife,
right,
and that she was involved in the plot and helping him to recruit and spread the word and that kind of thing. So then when I read her presence, I think twice in the trial documents, then the story for me really did become a love story. Because there's other pieces in the court documents that you have other men who were recruited sort of saying that the word was among the men involved in the conspiracy that they weren't supposed to tell the women. The mm-hmm. women weren't supposed to know. And then here's this one exception, this woman who not only knows but is involved. And
she's a leader.
Yeah, and is helping.
I mean, which, again, is something neat that you do in the book. You almost kind of create this Luke and Leia sort of, I mean, it feels very much like a, you know, from Hero with a Thousand Faces, sort of Joseph Campbell sort of feel to the story.
Oh, that's such a nice thing to say.
Which I think it already kind of has.
It does on its own, right? I didn't, yeah.
But you capture that really well. Thank you. And you assemble all the parts, and it really is an engaging read. And you don't whitewash much of anything. I mean, there's a stillbirth of Gabriel's younger brother, who I'm assuming that's probably
made up. That's made up. Right.
But I mean, it's affecting.
Everything is made up. It's fiction. Everything, meaning like, you know, some of the trial documents, some of the excerpts are there, and there's I have a big note on my website about which of the documents are authentic. So mm-hmm.
And there's a whole ton of it that's real. I mean, I know a lot of history, and so like things like the branding of his hand
to read
the gospel, or not read, but recite gospel.
That's
or,
right, the benefit of clergy
or
rule.
Or his teeth missing, mm-hmm. although we don't know when they went away.
Right, so those are things that I think a historian would have to speculate, an artist would have to imagine, and a fiction writer does too. So the reward notice for Gabriel does say that he had marks on his head and two of his front teeth missing. The first time that he really appears in the public history is in 1783 on an income property tax record of mm-hmm. Thomas Prosser's, where he had to pay taxes on everything that he owned. And so Gabriel, as an enslaved man, was owned by Thomas Prosser.
Who's probably responsible for paying most of Prosser's taxes at this point.
Say again?
I say I would guess he's probably responsible for paying a lot of the taxes on that property, too, Gabriel being a blacksmith. And
right. So the first time he shows up is in 1783. And so working backwards from when Thomas Henry Prosser mm-hmm. tells the newspaper that Gabriel is 24 in 1800, you sort of can back into the idea that so the first time he shows up in the public record, he was about seven mm-hmm. in 1783 on this property tax.
He's not
on this,
paying it then.
Not then, but he's gonna, he's going to be, right. So that's the first time he shows up in 1783. And then there's nothing about his life, specifically about him, in the public record until he interacts with the court system again, the criminal justice system. In 1799, he and his brother and their friend Jupiter, who was an enslaved next door, they steal the pig from Absalom Johnson. So
not
there's
to give
that,
away too much of the story.
Well, that's all there. It's history. It already happened. So there's that big gap between Seeing the evidence of Gabriel living at Brookfield when he was a little boy, 7 years old or so, and then when he's 23, being charged with maiming for the incident with stealing the pig and biting off the ear of Absalom Johnson in 1799. So then you have to sort of fill it all in. And
you do that.
Yeah, thank you. And that's so I did make a lot of that up. But I tried to do it in an informed way from reading about, you know, what were some of the common reasons that people, enslaved people, would have their teeth missing or mm-hmm. gashes on their face. And you start to sort of get the sense that sometimes these were people were marking the bodies of their slaves so that they could be more easily identified if they ran away. You would have some identifying marks. So it didn't seem like a stretch to make that kind of the case with Gabriel. And it seemed like an opportunity also to really talk about a characteristic of the institution of slavery.
Early in his life.
Right.
And it sort of sets him and his, almost surrogate brother.
Right.
Who's an important part of the story, too, apart. And that's Thomas Henry Prosser.
Right.
You didn't bring into the story, and I guess this is with the, it must have been a conscious choice, I'm assuming, the family that now around town and in Petersburg, this gentleman who's a descendant.
Dr. Bingham.
Dr. Mm-hmm. Bingham. And he's told this story where the family carried the name Bingham with them throughout, and it was sort of their almost secret name. You didn't get much into that sort of thing. There were certain things that you probably would have been difficult to weave into the story, or?
Well, so on the one hand, the Gabriel's Rebellion and Gabriel are public figures, right? I mean, they're part of our history. On the other hand, you know, there is a family history there that I've heard about. I have spoken with Dr. Bingham and told him that I was writing the book, and he's just a very gracious man.
He is.
And I sent a letter to another descendant. And at first I thought maybe I'd try to talk to them. But then it seemed like, you know, that's really not sort of the calling of this book. Because I think that's an important piece for the family to hold and tell in their way, right? So I didn't make an attempt to tell the family history.
For a later story is what you're saying?
No. I just think that's that family piece is for that family.
That's what I mean.
For, you know, yeah, exactly. For them to, maybe they have a story that they want to write. I don't know. Or tell. I lost my train of thought there, Jay. Let's see. This is, you'll just cut right through this, right? Okay.
Well, let me ask a question. As Gabriel reemerges, I suppose, from the mists of time.
Right.
And you've done a really great job of coaxing him out and his wife, Nan, as well. And then some of these other books, these scholarly works that are coming out. And, of course, the recognition of Gabriel with Young Spring now having a sign and down at the gallows having a sign there as well. This man is reemerging. And I did a recent piece that was looking at Richmond history, and I came across this amazing quote from Jefferson that's not really amazing. It was actually one of his least eloquent moments, which, you know, the guy was usually pretty darn eloquent, where he basically equates, and this is, again, where Jefferson is recognizing this guy in his dinner table talk about Gabriel's rebellion.
Right.
And he talks about, you know, how what you're sort of creating here is this idea of these people are asking for exactly the same freedom that the patriots asked for in our own revolution, and how are they different other than just they, you know, the weather, essentially, not to give away the ending of the book, but how are they different? And I guess the question is how important should Gabriel become in telling the story of Richmond, in telling the story of liberty and freedom and our country?
Gosh, that is the question. And, you know, I think he's incredibly important not only to Richmond, not just to Richmond or to our region, but to me, this is an important patriotic story. It's an important revolutionary story, and I think that when you think about like sort of a legacy, I think the story of Gabriel can speak to many different people together.
It's amazing. It's a wonderful book, and I'm almost done with it.
Well, you know how it ends.
I do know how it ends, but it's not in what happens. It's the telling of it, and it really is an amazing telling of a story that, you know, it's been for so long lost to history, and it seems to be slowly reemerging. And you did a great job of not just digging it up, but dusting it off and just painting it beautifully. So
thank you so much.
Thank you very much for coming in. Again, I'm here with, and I'm going to mispronounce her name unless I'm looking at it. So it's Gigi Amato.
Yep.
And she is the author of Come August, Come Freedom, The Bellows, The Gallows, and The Black General Gabriel. Gabriel Prosser's Gabriel. I was almost going to call him Gabriel Prosser. Prosser's Gabriel, who was a slave here in Richmond and led a slave revolt in 1800.
Right. Thanks a lot, Chris. This was really fun.
Thank you.
Broadcast of WRIR is made possible in part by VCU Arts and the Virginia Center for Architecture, ica.vcu.edu.
With the 2012 election just days away, and with Virginia on the short list of states likely to make or break the election for both presidential contenders, the Richmond region has revealed itself as among the state's key battleground locations. Even the least engaged Richmond area voter would have trouble ignoring the tug of war being played seemingly on a daily and very up close and personal basis. President Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, his challenger, have each spent a great deal of time in and around Richmond. It's easy to see why. In 2008, Henrico County, a previously staunchly Republican county, voted Obama by 58% with an 80% voter turnout. During the midterm elections, Republicans regained their edge, but they also lost one Board of Supervisors seat and the Commonwealth's attorney. We invited representatives from both statewide parties to join us today and talk about Richmond's place in the political bullseye. Calls to the state Republican headquarters on Franklin Street were not returned. Here with Brian Moran, who is the chairman of the Virginia Democratic Party, and we're going to talk a little bit about what we're looking at in the election here in just a few short days. What you're looking at is for the Democratic Party is looking at turnout as being critical, I guess, is sort of what I'm hearing.
Sure.
And reading.
I mean, if you just look in this area, nearby Henrico County, 80% turnout in 2008, which is just remarkable, and I commend the citizens in Henrico for turning out to that extent. And Barack Obama won Henrico County with 58% of the vote.
And now that's
the type of turnout it will require this year again for the president to be successful.
That's really the fascinating part of this story here locally right now is just how much in play Richmond is, or not Richmond City, but the Richmond metro area is very much seems to be a linchpin of what's going to happen in Virginia.
Right.
We've seen, of course, the president himself here a number of times. We've seen Mitt Romney has come. He was here on Wednesday.
Right.
He was almost immediately after the hurricane. As soon as he went right back into campaign mode, he was here.
Yeah, Virginia is a battleground state. Both candidates want it. We made history in 2008 as Democrats and helped deliver the presidency to Barack Obama by winning Virginia. That was the first time since 1964. So the Republicans recognized that, hey, Virginia used to be in their column pretty easily, and that's no longer the case. And Mitt Romney, very difficult to see him winning without Virginia.
Henrico in particular, though, has for a very long time been an indisputable stronghold for the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
Henrico certainly has. And you were just mentioning that Mr. Romney is going to be in King William. Or the president is going to be.
The president is coming to Prince William.
On
Saturday, and
I wouldn't think
Joe
of Prince
Biden
William as
back.
Being a particularly in play.
No, again, it Prince William in Loudoun. I was in Loudoun County this on Thursday. They both are swing counties, along with Henrico, and then you might Virginia Beach and Hampton Roads. Virginia Beach delivered 49% of the vote to Barack Obama in 2008. So these jurisdictions go back and forth, and they all went Republican in 2009. But if you look at the turnout numbers, it was less than 50% turnout. So again, as you look at this and say, okay, the more people who vote, the better the Democrats will do. And that's why such a get-out-the-vote campaign is going on over these last few days before the election. And I might also say, you know, the message and the messenger, you know, Barack Obama is a unique individual. He's a tremendous leader, been a great president. And his message of expanding our economy from the middle out, you know, investing in the middle class, making sure young people have access to higher education through the use of Pell Grants, making sure that the student loans did not double. It was about to occur this summer, and he made sure that they did not double. So again, it's so important for our young people to have access to skills and higher education. And that's critically important here in Virginia, where we have, you know, we're blessed to have so many great colleges and universities, VCU and our community college system.
When you're looking at well, I guess we call them independent voters, undecided voters. This seems to be a block of voters that is polling a little bit better for Romney right now, is some of what I'm reading.
Which block? The young, not the young voters.
Well, I guess where I've looked and seen some talk of this being an area that Mr. Romney is having better success than expected was among undecided voters and women.
Well,
What has shifted there, I guess, in
well, it's odd that women, and I'll grant you some of the polls have indicated that the gender gap is not as pronounced as it should be. You know, and all you have to do is look up the street at the Capitol and see what the Republicans did with respect to women's rights.
We've had some controversy in Virginia.
Some controversy. Yeah, the transvaginal ultrasound bill is such an intrusive procedure on a woman, unnecessary, unpaid for. The woman would have to pay for it and wouldn't even request it, and unnecessary. And so you would think that, and then the Lilly Ledbetter Act with respect, it was the first bill that the president signed.
With all these things, which again you would think would sort of solidify that base of women, why is that not having the...
Well, I think ultimately you will see a substantial gender gap. I think that there's inevitably some give and take in polls. And you saw the president with a wide lead in some states, and then you've seen some Mitt Romney coming back and forth. I think ultimately by Election Day, you will see a substantial gender gap. That's one of the reasons Virginia will go for Barack Obama, because I think the extreme ticket of Romney, Ryan, and Allen with respect to abortion rights, women's health care in general.
But again,
women
you're saying
tend to be
we'll
more
go.
Supportive.
You're saying we'll go, but again, we're seeing these candidates who have 49 other states that they could be in right now.
And they're all in Virginia.
And they're all in
which
Virginia.
Is, you know, I suspect your listeners probably aren't excited about the television ads that we've been saturated with, but it is exciting that the candidates come. So Virginians get to see, hear, and in some cases even feel, you know, go to attend and listen to the both candidates. And so I think that is good for Virginia because they really get to hear what they're saying and get to know the candidates.
We're definitely
going to
be
special.
A well-informed state this
I hope
year.
So, and the better-informed electorate, you know, Thomas Jefferson said that. I mean, we need to be a well-informed electorate to make sure our democracy survives.
So what are you guys looking at all? I don't know how deep into this sort of stuff you dig, but Henrico County in particular, obviously, is our listenership or some of it. Henrico County, where are you seeing? Obviously, Verina is an area that's shifted, but then again, we also had a countywide elected official for the first time going
a Democrat. Up against Eric Cantor, I mean, which was, you know, obviously a powerful figure.
And this was not a huge turnout election. It was off-year election for these county positions.
Right.
And
it goes to demonstrate it can be done. And with the right campaign and the right candidate, it can be done. And we're excited and confident that it will occur again. We have some great elected officials from Henrico. We're really working.
Now, Henrico in 08, you had some numbers with you.
80% turnout and 58% for the president.
58% for the president. And then again, like you said, during those midterm elections, it wasn't quite as...
It went
as,
down 46% and Republicans carried the day. So, you know, for me as Democratic Party chair, the good news is when Virginians vote, Democrats win. We need to get to that turnout, though, and that's a substantial turnout. And again, I commend the citizens in Noriko. That was really one of the highest in the state, if not the highest. I live in the city of Alexandria. We achieved about a 73% turnout, and the state average was 75%. Which is, again, extraordinary. Three out of four of our fellow citizens were voting. And you want as much turnout as possible so that, you know, that whoever wins has the support of the public. And so we certainly encourage everyone to get out and vote. And certainly those Democrats who are listening, make sure you bring 10 friends to the polls on election
day. Are you being strategic about what areas of the county you're looking at? Or is it digging down to that level at this point?
Well, the day and age, we have very good lists with the Democratic Party. We've really been working these lists over the time and canvassing. You know, we have volunteers who have been knocking doors since the spring in making phone calls. I'm heading over to Tim Kaine's office after I finish here to make more phone calls, because we're going to make those calls and door knock right up until 7 p.m. on November 6th. And what that allows you to do is find out who's leaning, who's open-minded, who's Republican, and who's Democrat. And I've, at home, received numerous pieces of mail from Mitt Romney.
Now, is that anything you guys are...
I'm not going to vote for you. I don't need your mail.
You're
wasting money on me.
Might be wasting money on you. You're volunteering full-time, you had said. Now
I am volunteering full-time and working hard at it. And a lot of other people are, too. There's a tremendous volunteer base of support for both Tim Kaine and Barack Obama.
Right. One of the things that Barack Obama really seems to have relied strongly on during his 08 win was that there were a lot of disaffected Republicans. Are you expecting to need that in this election? Or, I mean, can Obama win Virginia without that crowd of disaffected Republicans who seem to have sort of shifted back and they're doing a fairly solid job on messaging, it seems like, on the Republican side to say, hey, he's had 4 years.
Well, I've traveled Virginia. There's a lot of folks in 2008 who were very disturbed about the war in Iraq, that they felt, why were we there? We had been there a long time. What was being accomplished? We were losing the lives of our young people, and of course, in costs and billions of dollars as well. So that was one of the driving issues in the 2008 campaign, and certainly attracted a lot of people to Barack Obama. And Barack Obama now has terminated the war in Iraq, brought it finally to an end, is withdrawing troops from Afghanistan, has found and eliminated Osama bin Laden. So he has accomplished a great deal on that score. So,
but is that keeping those Republicans?
Well, you know, I don't know. And
Is it something that you guys are contemplating as?
Well, we reach out to everyone, you know. We're trying to bring our message to everyone, and
so that's why I guess the Republicans are sending their mailers to you.
I guess they're sending it to me.
But you're doing the same, I guess, is what I'm saying.
We're targeting. There is some targeting involved. Certainly, television ads broadcast to everyone. In terms of the point with respect to the mail is that we have volunteers on the ground finding out who's open to our message. And person-to-person contact is extremely important because, you know, you see all this television ads, but if somebody's at your door or on the phone talking to you, listening to you, what your concerns are, and then being able to address that voter's concern, you know, is it education? Is it women's rights? Is it the environment?
Retail politics.
You know, it's retail politics. Talk about what the president has done, what Tim Kaine is offering on those issues and has accomplished over his, you know, governorship. So we have a great record. We have tremendous candidates, and we're making that request at the doors in a person-to-person fashion.
Great. Thank you again very much for being with us today.
VADemocrats.org. check out the website, gottavote.com, if people need answers to any voting questions.
And again, Brian Moran, the head of the Virginia Democratic Party. Thank you very much for being here.
Vote November 6th.
Okay.
Thank you for having me.
All right.
Sweet Leilani, heavenly flower.
WRIR's programming is generously supported by the Richmond office of the law firm of Kaufman & Knowles. Kaufman & Knowles, Richmond lawyers serving the needs of Richmond business. For further information, call 804-771-5715 or visit www.kaufmanandknowles.com.
Let's face it, in the family of stringed musical instruments, the ukulele is the runt of the litter. It's hard to look cool playing it, and you certainly can't shred on it. But some people tend to like their less successful children the most, and the ukulele, which was created in Portugal but is associated more with Hawaiian music, is enjoying a bit of a renaissance right now. It's easy to transport, and musicians are discovering that it is highly adaptable to many forms of musical expression. To spread the word about the wonders of this small four-stringed axe, the Cultural Arts Center at Glen Allen is putting on a two-night celebration of the ukulele this weekend. It's called Uke Fest. Joining me today is Richard Cook, the performing arts manager of the Cultural Arts Center at Glen Allen, and Samson Tran, a local musician, composer, and arranger who will be showcasing at Uke Fest something called Uke and Roll. Welcome, guys.
Hi, Don.
Hey there.
Well, Richard, tell me about Uke Fest. What was the inspiration behind this?
We had several members of the River City Ukulele Society approach us. Huh? One in particular, Ron Gentry, spearheaded the event. Mm-hmm. He had gone to a Uke Fest in Strathmore, Virginia, a very popular one, and really thought it was a lot of fun and wanted to get one going here in Richmond. So he approached several of his friends who do a uke jam every Tuesday night, I think it is. Mm-hmm. And several of them then came to us and said, we really want to, you know, put together a festival for the ukulele. And we kind of went, well, let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. And the more we talked about it, the more we thought it should be kind of fun. So we said, let's do it. So several committee members and a year's worth of planning later, and we're about to put the ukulele, Uke Fest Virginia, on the map.
I was going to say, did you have to convince many people that this was indeed a valid event?
Yes. A lot of people would say, you're kidding. I didn't think that many people liked the ukulele mm-hmm. or even play the ukulele. And I believe, Samson might be able to back me up, it's one of the fastest growing and most popular instruments in the world right now.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it kicks off tonight with a concert, and then it's going to be an all-day thing tomorrow with workshops and other concerts.
We'll kick off with a concert on Friday night with Thomas Wakefield and the Aloha Boys. And then on Saturday, we'll have concerts and workshops. We'll have ukulele vendors and artisans. We'll have food and drink. It's just a day-long celebration.
Right. Now, the ukulele is normally associated with Hawaiian music. I assume that there'll be plenty of that on hand.
There will be. There'll be all kinds, actually, of variety of of ukulele music. The Aloha Boys and Leila Huna mm-hmm. are two groups who will show us the Hawaiian side. But we've got swing, we've got gypsy, jazz, old time, mm-hmm. pop. It's going to be a nice cover of ukulele music.
Well, Samson, you're best known for being like a saxophonist and an arranger of different types of music, and you're going to be presenting something called Uke and Roll. What is this?
It's a new teaching method that I worked on last year when I started a ukulele program at my elementary school. It's Glen Allen Elementary School with fourth mm-hmm. and fifth graders. Mm-hmm. And when I work on music, I generally do pop and modern rock songs. Mm-hmm. Well, when I say modern, it's like today's music to all the dating and music dating back from the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. And it's just presenting students with, well, here's a history of rock and roll. Mm-hmm. And by the way, and the ukulele was like a very fortunate accident to run into, because I mean, you can, with one finger, you can form a chord with no fingers, you can form a chord, or
right.
up to three fingers, you can form a chord. Uh-huh. And you only need like three chords, generally three chords for rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
and just incorporating that into ukulele into modern songs, I just said, it's not really rock and roll. I mean, why don't we just call it Uke and Roll? It has a catchy uh-huh. title to it. So, yeah.
So I'm guessing the kids also like that too, that they were able to make these chords with maybe one finger or two fingers.
Oh yeah, I mean it, because I had a constant battle with recorder. Third grade, we generally work with harmonicas, but mm-hmm. in fourth grade, students automatically enroll into recorders. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I can't talk down on the recorder, because that's what led me into playing saxophone. Mm-hmm. But I was like one of the few kids, and my experience with teaching recorder is that I felt bad being the guy responsible for making kids hate music. So there are great recorder teachers out there, and I that's just not my forte. So just running into Andy and Rita Nishida, who are also part of the River City Ukulele Society.
Right, and they helped organize the...
Yes, the committee.
Yeah. Yep. And what happened was I knew them through swing dancing and through my associating with them with my big band, the Upper East Side Big Band. And one day I was just having a conversation and said, you know, the PTA, they're offering me a generous amount of bread and I can spend on pretty much anything I want. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe a guitar program.
Now, you're teaching them music outside of their normal classroom work, or is this
part of
the...
No, that's part of it's a brand new curriculum.
Okay, cool.
And we're the only ones doing it. And but, you know, they're the ones who, Andy and Rita were the ones who suggested, why don't you just do ukulele? I thought, that sounds like a brilliant idea, like immediately.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because when I was in second grade, I actually started out on guitar and knew how difficult the instrument was because it's six strings, it's a larger body. And to teach, you know, 25 plus kids how to play chords at the same time, it's rather I found it rather difficult to, like, you know, do it on guitar. But with ukulele, you know, the way I view it is that they're seeing the patterns by shapes when they form a chord. And and the great thing about having them play chords is that you can also sing.
Right.
And the great thing about the instrument, you know, what I said, you can play a chord with no fingers, and that's already like a C6 or an A minor 7th. And then when you put one finger down, that's a C chord already. And instantly, I mean, it's one of those things with 25 kids. I mean, one teacher can say, well, you know, it's just 25, maybe 10 of them will, you know, get it. But, you know, after that, that's the great thing about, you know, education. It's like Tai Chi. It takes a long time for them to develop. Like, some kids will get it immediately. Mm-hmm. But just the other day, like, two kids came up to me and they were going over one song, which is Adele's Rolling in the Deep.
Oh, okay.
And it goes from, like, a G to a G7.
Uh-huh.
And then a girl said, how do you do a G7 chord? It's so hard. And the other kid was like, it's just like a G chord, only backwards. And I got schooled by a 10-year-old.
Right,
and
it's a great way to describe it.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. So.
Well, you said that you had actually picked up the ukulele just last year.
In August.
Wow.
From Andy and Rita. And it was just the right time at the right place where my PTA was cool enough to hook me up with the ukuleles. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I will say it was a lot of YouTubing, just looking at how players played and just doing research on the instrument itself. And are there like ukuleles in schools? And it's very few. It's still...
Yeah.
Little stepping stones, but I mean, I honestly feel like, you know, lots of inspiration will happen if, you know, every program, not only elementary schools, but elementary, middle, and high, if they had like a ukulele program, because eventually you can, the cool thing about ukulele that I discovered too is that the last four strings are like the same, you know, four strings on a guitar, you know, the last one. I was like, I didn't know that. And so I started playing guitar. I was like, huh.
So you can sort of transpose.
You can. Yeah.
Well, You Can Roll program, would you mind doing a song that you guys do in the You Can Roll?
Yeah, I can do a song that, you know, it's, we'll start off with The King. So,
okay,
yeah, sure.
There you go.
Yeah, cool.
Well, bless my soul, what's wrong with me? I'm itching like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friends say I'm acting white as a bug. I'm in love, I'm all shook up. Yeah. Well, my hands are shaking, my knees are weak. I can't seem to stand on my own two feet. Who do you think when you have such luck? I'm in love. I'm all shook up. Ooh. Ooh. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, please don't ask what's on my mind. I'm a little mixed up, but I'm feeling fine. When I'm near a girl that I love best, my heart beats so it scares me to death. Well, she touches my head, what a chill I got. Her lips are like a volcano that's hot. I'm proud to say that she's my buttercup. I'm in love. I'm all shook up. Ooh. Ooh. Yeah, yeah, yeah. My tongue gets tied when I try to speak. My insides shake like a leaf on a tree. There's only one cure for this body of mine. That's to have that girl that I love so fine. She touched my hand, what a chill I got. Her lips are like a volcano that's hot. I'm proud to say that she's my buttercup. I'm in love. I'm all shook up. Boom. Ooh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Ooh, 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 yeah, yeah. I'm all shook up.
All right.
Nice.
Very nice. Very
thanks.
Nice. Samson Tren with All Shook Up, ukulele style.
For more information about what's going on with UkeFest, we have the ukefestvirginia.com
ukefestvirginia.com, right.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
That'll give you like the performers, the schedule, the workshops, all kinds of stuff. Well, and videos like Samson.
I'm Don Harrison, and my guests have been Richard Cook, the performing arts manager, the Cultural Arts Center at Glen Allen, and musician Samson Tren. We've been talking about this weekend's special event, UkeFest. It's a two-day celebration of the ukulele slated to begin tonight at the Cultural Arts Center. For more information on the Little Big Show, go to ukefestvirginia.com. Hey, guys, thanks for coming on Open Source RVA.
Thanks, Don.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
And that's Open Source RVA for November 2nd, 2012. I'm Don Harrison, and my co-hosts are Chris Dovey and Amy Daniel. The producers are Jay Westerman and Gabby Schatzi, and the board op is Rachel Solomon. If you've got a news tip, drop us a line at opensourcerva@gmail.com. And don't forget to tune in Tuesday night at 7 p.m. for WRIR's special election night coverage, featuring national coverage from Democracy Now! And local coverage courtesy of WRIR and Open Source RVA.
Says on my folk song transcription anyway.
Shut.
Who is the man who would risk his neck for his brother man?
Shut.
Yeah. Can you dig it?
Shut.
Who's the cat who won't cop out when there's danger all about?
Shut.
Yeah, right on, brother. A complicated man, and no one understands him but his woman.
Shaft.
Yeah, John Shaft. Say, who is the folk song collector who collected all the folk songs?
Sure.
Yes, that's it. Who is the man who wore plus fours in the Appalachian Mountains?
Sharp.
Sharp, yes, says the sharp. Check this out. What's the most important thing about a coal mine, apart from coal?
Sharp.
No, no, no. It's the Davy safety lamp. Completely different piece of apparatus.
Sharp.
But check this one. Who's the guy who painted his face white, played the ukulele for a living?
Shaft.
No, he was Tim, Tiny Tim.
Somewhat extraordinary sounds of the Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain, and from one cult-stringed instrument to quite possibly another. To manage you both.